successes.
Unless you want your conversation to go
broadcast.
Additionally, to be broadcast, to be
broadcast to us back in chambers.
Is this a podcast? We can sort of download it.
Ms. Esposito, are you ready to conduct redirect?
Yes, thank you. Dr. Rust, if Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis is true, would it apply to regressive and classic autism alike?
It certainly should. It perhaps should apply more to the classic variety because there does seem to be a greater early vulnerability.
When you said before that you did not see a meaningful distinction between classic and regressive autism, and this was in reference to the slide that opposing counsel put up from Dr. Rutter, can you explain what you meant by that?
It's what I discussed earlier with regard to the early history of the child and the ensuing outcome and the appearance of the child at a particular age. There is a difference, of course, because the parents are telling us that the child has lost skills, and that seems to happen at a variety of ages and with no clear association with any particular life circumstance. So there are children that that seem to lose something that they acquired previously.
You were asked about the Charleston adult monkey study. Do you recall that?
I was asked about it, yes.
And in that study, there were very large doses of inorganic mercury given to the monkeys. Is that right?
And they seemed to me to be very large, and not only very large, but given very repetitively over a long interval.
Do you recall if there were any clinical symptoms that resulted from the monkeys being
So far as I know, there are no description of any clinical deterioration in the monkeys until the time they're sacrificed. So
nothing that resembled autism that you recall from that article?
No, I don't think there was any such thing.
If you could assume that inorganic causes of glial activation would, deposit, let me rephrase that. If there were other exposures to mercury in a patient's life, if they're otherwise exposed to different types of mercury, would you see any difference in the glial activation from one type of mercury over another type of mercury?
No. The difference demonstrated in those studies with regard to the amount of mercury accumulating over a short interval, I might say, in those studies, from the breakdown of ethyl as compared to methyl mercury, I think it's 2.1:1 or something like that. Given the doses, it's not particularly meaningful. It's a difference, but it's perhaps not a meaningful one. And then the question is, if we waited over a longer interval, since the presumption would be that methyl mercury taking a little longer to break down would ultimately equal the deposit of the inorganic mercury, it shouldn't be any different. And we also have the additional important contributions environmentally to all of us with regard to mercury. In comparison to those environmental, and especially in comparison to the amount of mercury in vaccines, for example, the doses given, especially to those adult macaques, were astronomical and daily for I think 3 months. So if
one were to suppose that inorganic mercury were the cause of autism, could you say for certainty that it was from the vaccine or any vaccines given to that person?
No, because, again, we have these other exposures.
With regards to the Vargas article, do you know if that group concluded that neuroinflammation was the cause of autism?
No, they didn't. They simply described a change that they observed by some somewhat indirect methodology and whether that was a response that was protective or a response that was something other than that is not known, but one certainly must think about the possibility that if this represented an issue where the nervous system was being challenged in some way, it might well be protective, could be related to architectural changes, could be related to other things. So there are lots of possibilities, and maybe more refinement and technique is very important in those kinds of studies as with others.
Thank you.
Any recross?
No recross.
Thank you. I believe my colleagues have some questions.
I do, and I'll try to be clear, Dr. Rust.
Thank you, Special Master.
If we take your figure of 90% concordance in identical twins in terms of autism in one twin and significant autistic-like symptoms in the other twin, even if they don't reach the diagnosis of autism. That's the 90% figure from your slide.
I think the 90% was referring to a genetic contribution estimated in, okay. in autism.
And we've heard in other testimony or in articles that we've read different concordance rates, but let's say that there is a 60% to 90% concordance rate. Those seem to be the ranges we've heard.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you account for the other 10% if we're looking at your what appears to be a strongly genetic explanation?
Now, that's a very important question. One would expect to see the disease express itself in both children with identical twins. That's right, because that's typically the way things present themselves. So it's a little puzzling, it's more than a little puzzling, and it's an important question. Other factors seem to influence risk, and perhaps they're not yet fully understood. If the genetic trait were to come from a particular parent, then one would still presume that the imprinting effect would be the same on both children. So if the genetic trait were passed on to both children by the same father. So there can be some differences in gene dose between children, as I understand. It's not an area I know a great deal about.
Okay. So we should address this to a geneticist.
Yeah, I think you'll get a more reliable answer than from me.
Let me just ask this question, and you may not know. I understand that Rett's is a genetic defect.
Yes, ma'am.
Special
Master.
That's all right, ma'am. It's fine. Listen to ma'am a long time.
It's my upbringing.
And you've drawn parallels between brain abnormalities in Rett's children and behavior in Rett's children and behavior and brain abnormalities in ASD kids, and among many other parallels you drew.
Yes, Special Master.
Is Rett's 100% concordant?
I believe that it is, but I'm not sure. That's another important question, especially relative to the prior question. But I believe that that's true. The counseling in these matters is done by our geneticists, and I may be wrong on that point.
Okay. Assume for the purposes of this question that the loss of language or the loss of words is real in some percentage of what we call regressive autistic.
Yes, Special Master.
What would account for that loss of words? Is there anything you are aware of?
It would seem to me it's the same thing that accounts for it. It's likely to be something similar to what accounts for it in Rett syndrome, because Rett disease, because that's what we see in the little girls as well. They have words, and then they disappear overnight. Or seemingly overnight. So that's among the things that the model is hoped will give us some understanding of. But it's quite a striking phenomenon, and so it does happen in Rett's as well.
But unfortunately, we don't know yet what causes it in Rett's.
Not so far as I know. It's an area developing so rapidly that almost by the week or the month we get something new.
Okay. You talked about the phasic, the sine curve of degeneration. Do you have any idea what generates that?
I probably was saying that confusingly. I was speaking about life itself goes up and down, and we see this all the time, whether it's headaches or epilepsy or behavior or other kinds of things. And the point I was trying to make there is that when the problems are great and we start some treatment and they get better, we're willing to take the credit for it. And then when they get, we see this in epilepsy all the time. Things get worse, and we give a higher dose, and they seem to get better. We do this for a while, and then we see the pattern goes on even when we're at high doses. This is not everybody, but it's some people. Then we begin to realize that sometimes life just does that, and perhaps we shouldn't take credit sometimes. So certain treatments, if administered to somebody, even if we think it's outrageous, may and is outrageous, it may appear to produce an effect that's valuable. And then if we see that it comes and it goes like that, whether it's our orthodox treatments or the ones we regard as unorthodox, we really need to sit back and figure out what it is we're really doing with those children. And then we need to assign in a carefully designed group the odds of making a child better, to say, look, we really know what we're doing with this, because we can so much increase the likelihood this child will not have this or another problem. When we do such studies, such as we do for drugs for very severe epilepsy, this is a particularly important comparison that we see with one of the worst kinds of seizures that occur in early childhood, called Lennox-Gastaut, where we see about a 50% likelihood that a very good drug is going to decrease the number of seizures meaningfully. In those studies, placebo does so at about 15%. So we've got to be careful in two directions. One is we've got to consider the possibility that something outrageous might be true, and we've got to consider the possibility that whether it's our treatment or other people's treatment, the report of improvement may simply be related to this change over time.
My question was a little different than that, but let me follow up on that. When we're looking at something like Lennox-Gastaut, we're looking at a discernible event, a seizure. In most cases, you can tell whether someone is having a seizure or not, particularly in that syndrome, correct?
Yes, special medicine.
You don't need, it's not the type of seizure you need to put them on an EEG in order to see it.
That's quite correct.
So, and we have a placebo effect there.
We seem to. Again, whether it's things going in the opposite direction, that things are just getting better for that child, is a likely explanation.
And when you are dealing with more subtle behavioral concerns, then you introduce an element of possible reporting bias.
It makes it very troublesome. There is some reporting bias problem likely when we're doing those seizure studies, and somebody's hopeful for an improvement, and the counting of seizures may not be quite so diligent. We don't know that to be true, but we do see this in terms of treating behavior for children with early childhood behavioral disorders, attention deficit, and so forth, that we seem to see more positive reports when the teacher's aware of the treatment as compared to not being aware of the treatment. Everybody wants somebody better.
Well, let me go back to my earlier question then, and what I heard you say in the Hazelhurst trial was something to do with switching from one part of the brain to another at various types of development. In other words, when we're born, our brain is functioning at a very primitive level. Other parts of our brain come online as we grow, and that, I think, was illustrated by your slide that took brains from birth to...
Yes, exactly so.
So is that considered one of the explanations for loss of skills or regression?
It is. The idea that, and that was the point I was attempting to make, that we have these ensuing signals that over time we either turn on or turn off a particular gene. For that matter, that response will turn on other sorts of things that happen, such as activation of cells that are important in elaboration or elimination of arborization or connections of various sorts. So these things, some of the most striking observations have to do with this issue of brain growth at different intervals and why in the world that's taking place. I mentioned that with regard to autism in the first year of life, but some wonderful studies that were done quite a few years ago showed that with early adolescence, brain size increases rather dramatically within what space is available to it in the skull at 13, 14, 15 years of age, followed by a stage during which that then goes away. And this is likely all those developmental changes that mark adolescence for the good and the bad of it, and things get reorganized and arranged, and it may take some kids longer than others, but things come back online with regard to different kinds of control and so forth, and people have discovered what they want to do in the meantime. So that goes way back to studies at the NIH that Charlie Kennedy did back in the 70s. So.
And does this switching have to have an external trigger? Can the trigger be in the gene itself? I mean, obviously in adolescence you have some triggers, hormonal changes that may influence that or may not. But I'm thinking of Huntington's, where there does not appear to be an external trigger. It appears to be an internal trigger.
Yeah, that's a very correct observation. Things such as hormones can play a particularly important role. So with hormonal changes for women in the second decade, aspects of immune function and brain function and vulnerability may change with regard to the endocrine axis changes, and do change in favor of having the ability to have children. This is a change in both immune system and endocrine system. As to whether external things modify these things, this is very tantalizing for people to understand. We know that with regard to the visual system, visual stimuli entrain the system, and not only entrain it, but it can change the way it functions based on visual changes. So if somebody puts on glasses that invert their vision and keep them on, the system will turn it back over again. So something happens to modify it. We don't understand it, but it's been known for a long time. So functions that are apropos of the particular developing system likely can make a big difference. We know this with regard to music. So that children that have musical experience to a considerable degree before 8 or 9 years of age have enlargement of the plenum temporale on the non-dominant side, which is the enlargement that accounts for perfect pitch, which is a mixture probably both of genes and experience. So some kinds of things can do this, but it's probably not every environmental stimulus that can do this.
And then I have one final question. You talked about several treatments for autism that are touted on the internet and other places that you do not consider effective.
Yes, Special Master.
You considered there is no evidence for them to be effective.
Yes, Special Master, that's
you
right.
You did not address one that we've heard a great deal about, and that's the gluten-free, casein-free diet.
Yes, it's been around for quite a while, and this is related to the recurring issue of leaky gut and called various things over time. The concept largely dismissed by the specialists in the area, but the gluten-free diet is tried for these things. We know a little bit about gluten as causing neurological problems very rarely, and we know that there are occasional individuals that develop unsteadiness because of gluten, and we know that there are some people with migraine who have a worsening of migraine with gluten. But with a gluten-free diet in those individuals, we've tried it. We never see the headaches going away entirely, and we don't know whether the modest improvement that takes place is pharmacologic or psychological. But we do know that in certain individuals, we can see some unsteadiness. Still, there are people that might argue we don't know this for absolute certain, and with regard to gluten and ataxia, and they'd be right. We don't know it for absolute certain.
But it's like you're not rejecting that one out of hand as having some impact on neurological improvement.
My own experience has been that that we don't see any benefit in the cases that come to me, which have never included one of those cases where ataxia seems to result from gluten.
That's all my questions. Thank you very much, Dr. Russell.
Thank you very much, Special Master.
Special Master, I actually did have a follow-up.
I think we've got some more questions, if you'll wait just a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I'm not the only one with questions this time. So.
I just have a couple. One was a follow-up on your description. If you called it a sine curve, the curve of, in response to Special Master Vowell's question, you mentioned that that's the way life goes in general. Now, did you also say earlier that applies to the symptomology of autism, that there's natural fluctuation? Was that the implication of what you were saying?
I raised the analogy in with regard to treatments and whether they're effective, but I think as with all individuals that have autistic features have things that go up and down over time, this can be a very difficult problem, especially in the second decade of life, with regard to how we treat things. When adolescence, on top of other things, seems to make some management problems so very difficult, and because we still have a great deal to learn about what's going on at that point, without coming to some really glib conclusion about why these things happen. But it seems to me that they do go up and down, and so we were especially helped by the fact that the mothers, it's typically the mothers of these individuals, become so very good at sorting things out and very observant. So often, as with many difficult problems, the fathers end up leaving. And so we try to map these things out over an interval so we can see between mother and myself if we're really making a difference, if we're making things worse, and see what we get. And then sometimes we need to bring the young man into the monitoring unit to see whether we can identify something electrical or something else that might be causing problems. And in that way, we've come to have some better understanding of certain things that happened during that interval.
All right. The other question is just, I want you to clarify for me, in slide 56 and probably a couple other slides in that same range, you used the term classic autism. Tell me how you define classic autism.
Typically, we've defined classic autism as a child that manifests the disease from early on, typically in isolation from a particular identifiable cause. Those are the children that we tend to call classic. They've been called that because they have so many features that satisfy the diagnostic criteria, and because they haven't experienced an obvious regression. The difficulty with those children, since we're identifying them very early on, is it may be more difficult to identify something regressive in the first year of life, although I don't think it's that difficult.
Let me interrupt you, because I think you answered the question. So you're making a distinction there between classic versus regressive, someone that didn't regress.
Yes, Special Master.
And are those both subsets of autistic disorder, the narrower category?
Yes, sir. That's how they used.
Thanks. That's all the questions I have.
Thank you, Special Master.
I think my range of questions have been touched upon. Thank you, Dr.
Thank you, Special Master.
Mr. Powers.
That time I was waiting. Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's okay.
Just a couple of quick questions, Doctor, to follow up on what
sir.
Special Master Vowell was asking about. With triggers, the finely tuned sequence of genetic on and off switches that are going on. In that finely tuned orchestration of genetic symbols, or signals, rather, is it possible for environmental factors to interfere first with the activation of the gene's message itself? Is that possible? Can an external factor switch off a gene that was going to switch on, or switch on a gene that was going to switch off at a particular time? Can that happen?
This is the sort of theory that's raised with regard to rubella embryopathy.
Can it happen?
It's possible. And the same thing with regard to cerebellar abnormalities in premature children, also prenatally.
And then an extension of that question would be, assuming the genetic signal goes at the right time, whether it's an on signal or an off signal, there's going to be something physical in the body reacting that to that, neurons migrating, for example. Assuming the genetic signal gets sent, can an environmental factor intervene to prevent the genetic signal from being effectuated physiologically?
I don't know of a particular example, especially after birth. It's possible, I reckon, but usually those kinds of interferences, when we understand them, have to do with some post-transcriptional modification that also seems to be explained by the working out of a genetic code.
And its potential effect on any symptoms would depend on the timing, I assume. So that if there was a signal that was going to turn an event in the brain on or off at a particular time, if there was an environmental effect that interfered with that, the symptoms might be different depending on when that happened.
I think that that is possibly correct.
Okay, great. No further questions.
Thank you. Any further questions from respondent? Any further questions? I think that concludes. Dr. Rust, you may be excused.
Thank you so much.
And that concludes our proceedings for today. Mr. Matanowski, are we on schedule for tomorrow to hear from two witnesses?
Yes, ma'am, we are.
Okay, and we are on schedule to commence again at returning to our 9 a.m. time.
Yes, ma'am, we are.
We are adjourned for the... we are not.
Just a quick question. It's really more... I don't know if the doctor would be included in the first question. One... is the slide reference in the slides to one of his articles, a 1991 article. I've looked through his report and can't see it cited, and we looked through the respondent's exhibit list and don't see any article with Dr. Rust as the lead author cited. So we would just request that the relevant article that's addressed in the slides be filed and give us a chance to take a look at it. And also, we conferred about this yesterday or the day before. We've requested that Professor Rutter's books that are cited in his report substantively be produced so that we can review those in preparation for his cross-examination. And we haven't seen the books yet. We just wanted to see when we would expect to see those presented for our preparation for his cross-examination.
As to the former issue, we'll be happy to get Dr. Russ' article. The reason why it wasn't submitted is that it was responding to the late developed theory here. Now, with respect to the books in Dr. Rutter's, mentioned in Dr. Rutter's report, we're trying to track those down. To the extent we do obtain them, we will be providing them. Of course, we received notice of this matter over the weekend, and you know that's made it a little, as opposed to at the time the reference list was provided, those were textbooks or books, and rather than trying to reproduce entire books, we were, you know, I guess one would figure, just as with Dr. Greenland's Modern Epidemiology, we didn't expect that to be produced by the petitioners. So, but we are trying to obtain them. However, there are many, and we don't have all of them, unfortunately.
All right, and since I'll be presiding tomorrow, may I inquire as to how long you're... we're not going to have another short day, I hope.
Tomorrow. No, ma'am, I don't believe so.
All right.
Thank you.
Anything else? We are adjourned.
No.